This is Backstory with us, the American History Guys. I'm Peter Onuf, 18th Century Guy.
I'm Ed Ayers, 19th Century Guy.
And I'm Brian Ballow, 20th Century History Guy. A 150 years ago this April, the first shots were fired in the American Civil War. In less than 4 years, more than 600,000 Americans would die, the equivalent of 6 million people today. And the largest and most powerful system of slavery in the world would grind to a screeching halt.
Now, if you were to travel back in time to the months or even weeks before that April of 1861, and you were to tell people that this was what they could expect in the near future, chances are they would think you were crazy. As much as they might have wanted that outcome or dreaded it, it just didn't seem possible that such a thing could happen in the 19th century. After all, politicians had been cutting deals about slavery going all the way back to the very founding of the country.
It's hard not to see things in hindsight when we think about the Civil War. To see it as a conflict that just had to happen, that was predestined, to understand its causes based on our knowledge of its results. But for the rest of the hour today on this special Civil War edition of our show, we're going to try to make sense of the lead up to that war, the way Americans at the time would have made sense of it. Our story begins in the winter of 1860.
Our last monthly paper announced the probable election of Abraham Lincoln and Hannibal Hamlin, the Republican candidates for President and Vice President of the United States. What was then only speculation and probability is now an accomplished fact.
This is the lead editorial in the December 1860 edition of Douglas's Monthly. That's Douglas as in Frederick Douglass, the famous abolitionist who had himself escaped from slavery 22 years before. Ed, this was such a crucial election. Can you give us a little background on who was running, what were the parties, all that stuff?
It's an amazing election. The future of the nation in the balance, and everybody knew it. The stage had been set really for over a decade as the Whig Party, which had been a strong national party tied to holding the country together, had disintegrated. The Democratic Party had broken apart between Northern and Southern factions. A new party, the Constitutional Union Party, had grown up trying to mediate between the North and the South. Also in the space the Whigs had left, the Republican Party emerges in the North that says that the territories may not be taken over by slaveholders. So election day comes. And what you find is that Stephen Douglas, sort of a moderate, and John Breckinridge, the strong pro-Southern candidate, split the votes of the big national party, the Democrats. The Constitutional Union Party wins lots of votes, especially in the upper South. But Abraham Lincoln wins 40% of the vote, all of it in the North. And with that percentage, he becomes president of the United States. So you have a new president, a brand new party, never in political power. And finally, in the South, some of the Democrats are saying, now let's start talking about secession.
Unquestionably, secession, disunion, Southern Confederacy, and the like phrases are the most popular political watchwords of the cotton-growing states of the Union. Nor is this sentiment to be entirely despised. If Mr. Lincoln were really a friend to the abolition movement, instead of being its most powerful enemy, the dissolution of the Union might be the only effective mode of perpetuating slavery in the Southern states. But the South has now no such cause for disunion.
Now hold on. This is Abraham Lincoln he's talking about, the great emancipator. And Frederick Douglass is calling him the abolition movement's greatest enemy?
And it's confusing, isn't it, Brian, especially for you 20th century people?
Well, here's the thing,
you know. So Abraham Lincoln really does hate slavery. He and the Republican Party say, we are not going to allow slavery to expand into the territories to pollute the rest of the nation, but they do not think that slavery can be ended where it now exists. So from an abolitionist like Frederick Douglass's point of view, they cannot help but be ambivalent about someone who acknowledges the constitutional right of perpetual bondage.
It's the same dilemma others have faced throughout our history.
This is David Blight, a Civil War historian who's written a lot about Frederick Douglass.
You advocate for something for perhaps all of your lifetime. Along comes a political persuasion or a movement or a party that kind of goes partway there. And sometimes you are most disgusted with those who seem to be on your side and yet won't act on it, versus those you know are not on your side and will never act on it.
With an abolition president we should consider a successful separation of the slave from the free states a calamity greatly damaging to the prospects of our long enslaved, bruised, and mutilated people. But under what may be expected of the Republican Party, with its pledges to put down the slaves should they attempt to rise and to hunt them should they run away, a dissolution of the Union would be highly beneficial to the cause of liberty.
What he wants to happen is an all-out break that forces some kind of organized military action against the South. He says that only then would slavery really, really be threatened. And he's actually saying to the secessionist here, you know, if you just back off and cool it and you stay in the Union, your godforsaken slave system's going to last a heck of a lot longer than if you bolt the Union. But he wants them to bolt.
In truth, we really wish those brave, fire-eaten, cotton-growing states would just now go at once outside the Union and set up for themselves. But no, cunning dogs, they will smother their rage. And after all the dust they can raise, they will retire within the Union and claim its advantages.
Douglas actually predicts this over and over, that what will really happen will be yet another compromise, something on the lines of the Compromise of 1850. He sees this ultimately being assuaged by compromise, and that's his worst fear. You know, he wants one thing, he expects another, he fears where this is going. But note how he says that what at least has happened, and this he celebrates, is that for the first time, American political culture was under the control of people who, to some degree, were threatening the future of slavery.
For 50 years, the country has taken the law from the lips of an exacting, haughty, and imperious slave oligarchy. The masters of slaves have been masters of the Republic. They were the president makers of the Republic. Lincoln's election has broken their power. It has taught the North its strength and shown the South its weakness. More important still, it has demonstrated the possibility of electing, if not an abolitionist, at least an anti-slavery reputation to the presidency of the United States.
Now, that sounds like such a half measure, but it meant a great deal to an abolitionist like Douglas. It's like this new order of things, a new order of events that is about to take place. The trouble is they just don't know where these events are yet going.
That's David Blight, professor of history at Yale University. We'll post a full version of my conversation with him at backstoryradio.org.
So, guys, we understand pretty well that Northerners were worried about slavery spreading to the territories and continuing a Southern domination of politics across the Union. Were there equivalent fears in the South about Northern strangulation of the political rights of Southerners?
Yeah, Brian, let me pick up on that, and I'll kick it over to our good friend Ed. And I'd say absolutely there were great concerns that now that the Republicans were in control of the national administration, that this was the culminating chapter in a long narrative of Southern victimhood, believe it or not. That is, that the Federal Union had been redistributing wealth through its commercial system, the tariff, navigation laws, yeah, and so forth. And that, in effect, the South had been subsidizing the North.
Let me just stop there, Peter. You mean that this tariff was protecting Northern industries,
yeah,
but disproportionately taxing Southerners?
But even when the tariff went down, they analyzed the whole commercial system and saw a maldistribution of benefits, that they were flowing to the North. In other words, the real problem for the South was democracy. That is, under the Constitution, it would be possible for a hostile majority to seize the reins of central power, and they'd been waiting for that to happen since 1787.
And so here's the terrifying vision of secessionists, that Abraham Lincoln has a brand new party. They've never been in the presidency before, but as soon as he builds the network of patronage that's going to span all the ports and post offices of the South, my goodness, what could you do then about abolitionist literature? What could you do then about building party strength?
So, Ed, you're suggesting that there's a fear among some Southerners that Republicanism might gain some traction in the South.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, 3/4 of white Southern men are not slaveholders. Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't those guys want to say, you know, what I'd like to have is a party that's really for me? That's not, you know. And why is this plausible? because the South has had a two-party system until very recently, which has just collapsed. So there's a vacuum there that all these former Whigs, all these former people who believed in a lot of the things Republicans believe in, which is using the federal government to build railroads and canals and all this sort of stuff, they could be pulled into the Republican Party, and the South would begin to fragment from within. And as soon as you have that happen, goodness knows what would happen with the enslaved population if they thought they had some white allies.
So that's a very good explanation of kind of the apparently quite realistic assessment of the politics. But what about the fear of race war? What about the kind of racial situation on the ground?
Well, I've got two words for you, Brian. John Brown.
Yeah.
Now remember, it's only in 1859, just the preceding year, that he leads a campaign, as he says, to begin the end of slavery through the black men themselves rising up against their masters, and hands out all these pikes and things, right? So they look around and they think, well, we don't know who Abraham Lincoln is. Who knows what he's going to do? But what we do know is maybe those black people were listening and they're waiting for the next John Brown. And that when the political system becomes destabilized, that they will seize the opportunity to rise up against us.
Yeah, and it's worth remembering that throughout American history, servile insurrection, the uprising of slaves, is associated with outside interference. You go back to the American Revolution and Lord Dunmore's proclamation in March 1775, freeing Virginia slaves, that's the last royal governor, come to our lines, join us. In a way, that's the thing that Southerners would fear. It's not that their slaves would rise up spontaneously by themselves, because they think they've worked it all out.
Right.
Because slavery is becoming a more efficient, even, we hate to say it, but a more modern and effective institution.
Right,
and I think
right.
what you're saying, Ed, is that it's this vanguard of aliens, foreigners to the South, Northerners representing the administration, who could tip the balance in dangerous ways.
Fascinating. And of course, you guys know that persists into the 1960s, when the first charge against people demonstrating peacefully for their rights, simple rights, outside agitators, because our own people, although subject to Jim Crow,
they know their place. Right.
Yeah, they would never do this without outside agitators.
I'm Peter Onuf, the 18th century guy.
I'm Ed Ayers, the 19th century guy.
And I'm Brian Bellow, 20th century guy. Today on the show, we're marking the 150th anniversary of the Civil War's beginnings with an in-depth look at the pivotal 6 months before the fighting started. In the first part of the show, Ed and Peter were explaining how utterly different the election of Abraham Lincoln looked in the South to the way it looked to abolitionists in the North.
Now, we should be careful to point out that the North and the South were hardly monolithic entities at this time. Very few Northerners were committed abolitionists. In fact, Northerners were more likely to think that slavery kept black people in their places. And in the South, just because practically everybody hated Lincoln, that didn't mean that they were ready to walk out of the Union. According to Civil War historian William Freeling, in fact, that was very much a minority position in December 1860.
So the problem for the minority of secessionists is to figure out how they can get the majority out. And the thing they must above all else avoid is a Southern convention. Because in a Southern convention to decide the issue of secession, they're going to lose. What they have to do is do it state by state. And when enough states seceded, then there would be enormous pressure on the majority to reconsider its position.
South Carolina is where the secessionists make their first stand. 3 days after the election, it announces it will hold a convention to debate secession. And a few weeks later, that convention votes unanimously to leave the Union. University of Virginia historian Elizabeth Varon says that to understand why South Carolina was the first to go, we need to understand this demographic fact.
South Carolina is one of the two southern states on the eve of the war that has an African-American majority, 59% of the population. What this means as a practical matter is not that blacks have any voice in the politics of the state. Of course, they don't. This is a slave population. But it does signify a sort of overweening dependence on slavery. So South Carolina has long been at the forefront of the defense of the institution.
In fact, South Carolina had been at the forefront of that effort ever since the 1830s. Back then, South Carolina said, when there is a law that directly contradicts the interest of a state, it may be nullified, rendered null and void. And South Carolina staked a lot of that back in 1830, 31. It lost. President Jackson called their bluff. But the idea that the federal government should not be able to endanger the rights of slaveholders and the security of white people in a predominantly black state endured, and it came up again here in the secession crisis.
My father was a South Carolina nullifier, governor of the state at the time of the nullification row, so I was of necessity a rebel born.
This is a passage from the diary of Mary Chestnut, one of the most famous documents of the American Civil War. In addition to being the daughter of a former governor, Mary Chestnut was also the wife of James Chestnut, the first U.S. senator to quit the Senate after the 1860 election.
I remember feeling a nervous dread and horror of this break with so great a power as the United States. But I was ready and willing. South Carolina had been so rampant for years. Come what would, I wanted them to fight and stop talking. So I was a seceder, but I dreaded the future.
Americans, Southerners included, had long been encouraged to dread disunion and indeed to imagine it as the worst possible thing that could befall their country.
Historian Elizabeth Barron.
And this image of disunion as something that was just a cataclysmic, apocalyptic, tragic outcome had a great deal of political utility because invariably, when anyone in the days of the early antebellum period proposed something radical, they were accused of wanting disunion, of fomenting disunion, of opening this Pandora's box. So, for example, when abolitionists came along and proposed the immediate emancipation of the slaves, those who supported the slave system said, ah, you're disunionist. You want to alienate North from South and prompt this kind of terrible, unwinnable war. And women's rights advocates were accused of the same thing. So people like Chestnut had to unlearn this long-standing set of assumptions. To embrace secession, they had to unlearn the idea that disunion was just a dreadful and horrific prospect.
By the winter of 1860, that lesson was well on its way to being unlearned. In fact, one of the most famous quotes from this period is from Mary Chestnut's husband, the U.S. Senator, or rather ex-senator. A few days after South Carolina seceded, he reportedly said this to a fellow South Carolinian who was nervous about the future.
There will be no war. It'll all be arranged. I will drink all the blood shed in the war.
The secessionists had the sort of rose-colored view of what secession would mean. Some of them thought the North would quail in the face of this secession movement and either sort of let the South go after a sort of brief dust-up or give the South what it wanted. Interestingly, it was the Unionists in the South who said, yes, secession's going to bring a war, but it's going to bring a war we can't win.
And one thing we would need to pause to point out, I think, is that secession was not the only way to protect slavery, and that if people opposed secession, and by people I mean the slaveholders of the South,
right,
does not mean that they were somehow less committed to slavery than secessionists
were.
That's
such an important point. The debate between Unionists and secessionists in the South is not a debate over slavery per se. It's a debate about how best to protect slavery, whether slavery, which has thrived in the Union, as the Unionists say, will continue to thrive in the Union, or whether slavery is in mortal danger unless the South secedes. And Unionists are absolutely saying the surest way to destroy slavery is to bring a federal army down here. Absolutely.
Once again, we see how the election of Lincoln meant so many different things to so many different people, even people who were supposedly on the same side. But Barron told me that in many ways, the secession debate was about a lot more than politics.
One of the things the secessionists do so well in those critical months in which this all has been debated is tap a kind of martial fervor, particularly among men, particularly among young men, the idea that this war can not only be short and sweet, but it can be fun. It can be a break from the ho-hum of everyday life. It can be a field in which men can win honor and glory and the hearts of women and all the rest. And there's a lot of young men in the South who are eager to sort of recapture the glories of the South's early history, the time when it dominated the federal government and all the rest, who are very susceptible to this kind of argument.
So as we go into secession, there's this strange amalgam of dread and exultation in the South, right?
Right.
And a sense, it's not that people can't imagine the terrible things that will happen. They just don't think they're going to.
They just don't think that they're going to, exactly. And I mean, this is something that is puzzling. Many people have said to me, couldn't these guys crunch the numbers? You know, it was obvious that the North had not only more people, but more industry and more of everything, even more agricultural output. But the secessionists perceived that the South had other advantages that they believed would bring them a quick and decisive victory.
That's Elizabeth Varin, a historian at the University of Virginia. We'll link to some of her work and to audio of my entire conversation with her at backstoryradio.org.
Well, Ed, picking up on what Liz just said about the confidence of secessionists, it would be a quick war. Why didn't they understand what they were up against?
Yeah, it's a little eerie to see how confident the South is. Mm. It's not merely that they're playing defense. Oh, our rights have been infringed. They're going, here's our chance. We control the world's dominant commodity.
King cotton. Yep.
We have a monopoly over the equivalent of oil of today. Our labor force has never been worth more. Slaves are worth more than all the railroads and factories and banks of the North added up. And why would we want to constantly be harangued by these Yankees about our moral failings, about our economic failings, about our political failings? If they don't like us, and they just demonstrated that they don't, hell with them. Let's leave and be the fourth richest economy in the world by ourselves.
And Ed, wouldn't you say that there is this assumption that when push comes to shove, they won't stop us because they've always buckled in and rolled over in the past within the context of federal politics. We've had our way. So let's call their bluff definitively.
Exactly. And here's another reason. Why would they roll over all the time? Because they need us. Yeah. More than half of all exports are coming from the slave South. The entire northern economy is driven by the cottons coming out of the slave South. So not only are they morally bankrupt and sort of hypocrites and blowhards, but they are under our economic heel.
They just didn't think the Union was really even going to fight.
Yeah, there was no will there.
And it does seem on that, because there had been so many compromises, because there had not been civil war, that there really might not be. I mean, I guess I can understand why reasonable people might think that.
But the fact is, as Liz points out, other reasonable people said, you're crazy. in the same debate. So it's not like they couldn't imagine it.
Right.
So where is the soft underbelly of the Unionist that they are not being manly?
Yeah.
And the phrase, and I want you to strap yourselves in because this will hurt your feelings. Mm. The phrase that they would use, what's the opposite of a secessionist? Not a unionist, but a submissionist.
Mm.
You would submit. Oh. You'd roll over for the Union.
Yeah.
And so that's what the Unionists had a very hard time fighting against.
So guys, did women think about this in the same terms that we've been talking about?
I would say,
doubting people's manhood.
Yeah, I would defer to Ed on this, but my guess is that women, in fact, take that on in a very big way. In some ways, men can waver, but women are pretty sure. They're pretty clear on what a man would do if we were men. That is so much the plaint of Civil War women. How can we show our patriotism if we were in your place? We would do this.
That's exactly right. And so if you're going to protect me, then you're going to act in a manly way. And of course, this is the other place the Unionists are saying, honey, I am protecting you by not going to war. But the thing is that there's not a manly language of compromise.
What happened to the presumably manly language of compromise that had served the nation for decades?
Well, yes, to the extent that we revered the fathers and their statesmanlike vision and prescience when they created this strong, more perfect union, then by all means, that was the epitome of manhood. But that's old manhood in a way. And there's a language, a subversive generational language of youth rising up. And it takes the form of calling these compromisers, and using that word compromise in the modern pejorative sense, these guys were old fogies.
Yeah. And so looking back, you know, we tried so hard, historians, to try to figure out who's voting for these people? Who's voting for the Republicans? Who's voting for the secessionists? And the main pattern they've been able to find is that it's young men on both sides. The Republicans have this group called the Wide Awakes that are not even able to vote yet, but they're out marching and carrying torches and things, kind of a paramilitary. And down south, it's the guys who are saying, I've been listening to this crap my whole life. Let's go. We don't want these old guys compromising our rights away one more time. The irony, of course, being the young men who are saying these things are the very ones who are going to end up dying in the trenches of the Civil War.
In the momentous step which our state has taken of dissolving its connection with the government of which we so long formed a part, it is but just that we should declare the prominent reasons which have induced our course.
On January 9, Mississippi follows South Carolina out of the Union.
Our position is thoroughly identified with the institution of slavery, the greatest material interest of the world.
The following day, Florida follows suit.
We have not acted in haste or in passion, but with the utmost deliberation and from what we regard as immeasurable necessity.
Alabama goes the next day, and a few days after that, Louisiana and Texas. On February 4, representatives from all seven states meet in Montgomery, Alabama, to draw up a new constitution. Now, it's often said that the original constitution was a pro-slavery document. There was the part about slaves counting as three-fifths of a free person, and that other bit about all states having to return fugitive slaves. And the fact that it was ratified at all testifies to how much the slave states felt that it did protect them. But the Confederate Constitution took the protection of slavery to a whole new level. Here's the Confederacy's newly elected Vice President, Alexander Stevens, explaining the new and improved version of the founding document.
The prevailing ideas entertained by Jefferson and most of the leading statesmen at the time of the formation of the old Constitution were that the enslavement of the African was in violation of the laws of nature. It was an evil that they knew not well how to deal with. But the general opinion of the men of that day was that, somehow or other in the order of providence, the institution would be evanescent and pass away. Those ideas, however, were fundamentally wrong. They rested upon the assumption of the equality of the races. This was an error. It was a sandy foundation, and the government built upon it fell when the storm came and the wind blew. Our new government is founded upon exactly the opposite idea. Its foundations are laid. Its cornerstone rests upon the great truth that the Negro is not equal to the white man, that slavery, subordination to the superior race, is his natural and normal condition. This, our new government, is the first in the history of the world based upon this great physical, philosophical, and moral truth.
So, guys, you know what's amazing to me? The word that's repeated several times in here is new. You know, we think of the defense of slavery of race as being the oldest kind of archaic attitude possible.
Yeah.
But what he's saying, that was okay for the old-fashioned 18th century, but now in the 19th century, we know better that the Negro is not equal to the white man.
No, that is so absolutely right. And it's because of emerging understandings among racial scientists, anthropologists, ethnologists in the 19th century about racial difference. It's because of this realistic political economy that is a sense of what makes the world turn round, and that would be cotton, which is king. This is getting past the platitudes and the banalities of the Enlightenment, of the founding era. All men are created equal? I don't know about that, because they certainly didn't practice it if they believed it, that is, the founders. And the idea that slavery would go away, no, it so manifestly had not. It is a robust institution. So let's face the facts. You can say this is that pragmatic, realist American go-go spirit.
And you'll notice the very last sentence, they see this as not just a continuation of something else, but the beginning of a new world order.
Yeah.
This, our new government, is the first in the history of the world based upon this great physical, philosophical, and moral truth. It's hard to imagine a more chilling phrase in all of American history. that this could have been the truth.
Yeah.
It could have been the first new nation based upon the great truth, as they imagined it, of black inferiority.
Yeah, but Ed, that reminds us of the American founding, when that same notion of being in the forefront of world history, offering a model for the rest of the world, that was very much the language of newness in 1776, 1787.
Well, it's lucky that we're all about the old, guys. It's all I can say after hearing this discussion, because new is really pretty dangerous.
Yeah, well, you know, the underlying issue is the question of how the United States and our history is defined according to timeless values. In effect, Lincoln refutes the notion of newness when he invokes the spirit of Jefferson and says, listen, those principles of 1776 articulated in the Declaration, they are the principles that constitute our creed. This is the church we worship in, all of us. This is the rock on which this nation is built. That is, to think that the principles of the Declaration infuse the Constitution, all men are created equal, that that's foundational to how we should understand the Constitution. Well, we like to think that today. But Lincoln is really the author, if you will, of that conflation of those two great documents. It's time now for a short break. When we get back, we'll look at why so many men in Virginia, the Old Dominion, were so reluctant to join up with the brand new Dominion. You're listening to a Civil War special edition of Backstory, and we'll be back in a minute.